Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests, co-hosts, friends to help you lead a more positively minded life. Information, stuff that you might consider that could turn around some of that other stuff. Of course, there's another way we could start the program. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Negative Mind. You know, here on WBAI, bringing you nothing so that you could live a more miserably minded life. We could do it that way, too. You know, both ways seem to attract people. My way is the first way. Now, I guess it's a need of mine to attract people in such a way that they want to listen to what we're doing. And we're getting listeners. We have Catherine Reed, who is now listening from Dublin as we speak, and Catherine Wallace, who's listening to us today, just saying hello, and a whole bunch of other Catherines. To all the Catherines out there today, happiness. And Catherine Eklund, of course. Hey, listen, we were talking last week about the original hierarchy of needs by Maslow. And this is going to lead us into a little bit about self-discovery tools, hopefully today, that you could learn about yourself so that you could improve yourself.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Armand, but since we were last on the air, I've definitely been getting my needs for daylight and warmth met a lot better. It's been beautiful out, and I'm feeling a change now with the season. It's on a very like physical, biological level now that it's warm out and that there's more sunlight with daylight savings. I feel just physically and mentally better.
There seems to be something about this winter's depression that was unusual.
It was a tough one.
From what I've seen from people, now I know people who have seasonal affective disorder who don't feel very different in the winter than they do during the summer. The people who have seasonal affective disorder do feel very different, but this one seemed to grab a lot of people. There's something that's happened that grabbed people in a place, and it was a lot tougher winter.
Yeah, it kind of shook your bones this time around, didn't it? I felt it like chilling inside your body, you know, definitely.
Inside whose body?
Inside my own body.
Inside your body, right. And you're young, so you don't get chilled in the body.
Yeah, it doesn't
often
happen. Usually I don't feel that way about winter. I mean, growing up in New York, I haven't really been too affected. I always kind of like the winter. The snow is fine. But it was a sort of really bone-chilling kind of winter this time for me.
And it hit you in the mood too, right, Julian?
Yeah, it really took me down to a different place. And being inside so much of the winter is probably a big part of it too for me.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Being inside sometimes means being inside with yourself.
Right.
With the outside, you have the distractions. What are our basic needs? What is it that we need in order to be okay in this world? Let's go back to Maslow.
Sure. Last week, we talked about the first three needs on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And the first level of those needs are biological and physical. So these are just the rudimentary, most basic things that we need to stay alive day to day, like air to breathe, food to eat, water to drink, shelter, warmth, sleep, and sex. And we also talked about safety needs, which are a bit more complex, but are still fairly basic needs like protection from the elements, security, stability, freedom from fear, and a feeling of order and law in our world. And, of course, we also hit the third level of needs, which is love and belongingness. And that's really where we delved into in detail. We talked about the need to feel a part of a group and the need to feel a kinship with others around us. So that's whether it's through friendship or intimacy or affection, whether that's coming from family, friends, or colleagues.
These are basic needs, whether or not you're sane, crazy, neurotic, not neurotic. You just got to get these needs settled. Now comes the next one, which is called the esteem needs. What are they, Ben?
Well, the esteem needs are a bit more complex and nuanced. So once we've had our basic needs met, the first few levels that we just discussed, we start to crave the needs of esteem, meaning things like achievement. So whether that's in a skill or a job, the mastery of a skill set or a career goal, and the independence and status that comes along with that, the prestige and the respect that we get from those things. So maybe it's playing an instrument. I want to set out on this journey to learn a certain instrument and get really good at it. That way I'll feel good about myself and others will respect that ability too.
But if you're doing, let's say, an instrument, you're learning an instrument, do you have to play it so that somebody else appreciates it? Or do you have to play it to a point where you like what you hear?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that kind of bridges the gap between the esteem needs and the next level, which are self-actualizing needs. I think the most important thing is to play it to the point where you are satisfied.
Let me ask Julian. Julian, as an actor,
sure.
When you're presenting a role and you're doing a getting ready for a role or getting ready for a tryout, is it you who's got to be satisfied or is it the recipient?
Well, it's interesting because it gets really complicated in that sense, but I know that the only thing I have control over is the performance that I give and how comfortable I feel with my own performance. So, I mean, as I've matured as an actor, I've realized that you can't control, or I couldn't control, what the other people thought. Only could I do the work and feel good about myself doing the work.
So we don't care much about what other people feel, except you do care.
I do, but I kind of learned that over time that you don't really have control over how the other people feel, that as long as I do what I can do on my end, I have to leave it up to them.
Well, what if what you do is arrogant and people don't like it? And then you wonder, why don't people like it? Like, I knew a guy who was a joke teller. He was a comedian. And he always told jokes about defecation.
Right.
It was in everything every joke he ever told, he had some reference to bowel movements. Every joke he ever told. And the audience would laugh hysterically, but nobody ever came back to see him. See, so he was doing things that were aggressive and out there, mm-hmm. but nobody wanted to hear him. You know, he's like, he had a thing on himself. So he loved his work. At what point do you love your work and you hope that your work is also loved by others? That's that bridge. You know, I would even ask Charlie, who's in the studio with us, Charlie Schwinkert, who is a professional jazz drummer, who's with us and one of my teachers. Charlie, when you're drumming, at what point do you feel that you've hit that perfection?
I don't think I've ever felt like I've hit that perfection, honestly. A lot about jazz drumming is, well, specifically jazz drumming, but any sort of instrument in general is just ironing out everything, and that's like everything to the point where it's nothing. You don't think about anything at all. It's as if I'm talking to you right here, right now. It's like a language.
At no point do the people disappear and you're just hearing yourself. Like, I was listening to you just do a basic drum roll the other day. And I was saying, Jesus, look how beautiful that is. Mm-hmm. You don't care. The audience disappears. It's you being perfect for you? Or is there always some kind of a silent critic somewhere?
There's always a silent critic in my own mind, of course. Yeah. As far as my relationship with the audience, I mean, I always try to cut them out. I mean, I get nervous. You know, I don't like to think about how many people are looking at me, how many people are thinking about what I'm playing or whichever. You know, it's hard enough just to play. You know.
Well, like right this second, Charlie, here you are talking on a radio to millions of people. Are you conscious at all about the fact that your voice is traveling across? Well, there's at least 10 people out there.
Yeah, at least. But yeah, it's the same concept. I mean, I just try to. I guess in that sense, I don't know if it means it is for the other people. You know, if you're. I don't know whether I'm playing drums for myself or playing drums for them, if it does affect me in that
if
way.
If you play for yourself, and if you bring yourself to a certain point, and it's not an antagonism of other people, right, then something beautiful happens, and somehow your music becomes love, or part of it. Your performance becomes love.
Well, I definitely relate to a lot of what Charlie said. I mean, I'm not a professional by any stretch, but I am definitely a musician, and have been for a long time, and there's never been a point where I felt a full satisfaction in what I played, even when other people who were listening told me they really enjoyed it. I think part of being a creative person, or an artist, if you will, is a constant hunger to be better.
Well, you know, to you audience, you dear friends of WBAI, you're going to get a chance next week and the following, the rest of this week and the following week, to see how these youngins, my associates, pulled together the positive mind, because I am taking a vacation. I'm going to be out of town starting tomorrow, and I'll be out for that and the next two ones after that, and they're going to either be playing repeats of old programs or create some creative programs that they're putting together themselves. Let's wish them luck. You know, let's wish them luck. Send them feedback if you can. They're very excited. Are you excited about this?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's going to be a great experience. I'm very excited.
Right, even if they throw the tomatoes at you.
Even if the tomatoes come. It's actually interesting. You were talking about Charlie performing. I just saw him this weekend playing drums. And
I saw the video of that. Yeah.
And I showed Armand a video, a quick video that I took, and you get so in the zone that... It's interesting because you don't look at the audience. You are so in it, and it's great to watch that, just you in that orb of drums happening, you know, and you were great.
Well, thank you. Really thank you very much.
Hey, so Charlie Schlinkert is his name. Mm-hmm. Keep your eye on that, my friends, because that name will be coming up again and again. Now, let's talk about this esteem need. So you got to be respected by others. You got to have self-respect. Self-respect is a difficult thing, and we're going to talk about how you can get that more in the program. The last of the needs is called the self-actualization needs. What does that mean?
Self-actualization is the most complex of the whole hierarchy of needs. It's all the way at the very top, and many people will never get there. Self-actualization is maximizing our personal potential, right? Fulfilling our best version of ourself. So it's a process. It's a lifelong process of growth that really, I think, is a lifelong struggle. And we have...
There are characteristics of self-actualizers, right? Like, one thing they do is they perceive reality efficiently, but they can tolerate uncertainty, which is a very interesting thing, a way to be. If you're self-actualized, what does that mean? You know, it's a terrible word. Self.
Yeah, it's hard to get a visual when you say it.
Self-actualized, I don't get it. Now, another thing they do.
They accept themselves, and they accept others. Simply for who they are.
And that means you don't get angry at people because they're different than you are. So I guess the positive mind is a self-actualized show. We perceive reality efficiently, and we tolerate uncertainty. We accept people for who they are. Spontaneous in thought and action. Well, we do that around here, that's for sure.
Definitely.
Right, ask Charlie, sure. We have an unusual sense of humor, which is kind of interesting, how everybody sees the world. Able to look at life objectively. Highly creative is a part of self-actualized. Resistant to enculturation. What do you think that means, Ben?
Enculturation? I don't even think I've ever heard that word, Armand.
It's being part of the culture.
Is that like assimilation?
Yes, you're resistant to it. You don't want to become a part of everybody else, but you're not purposely unconventional.
So right, you're strong enough to be an individual, but not...
defiant.
Right.
Yeah, you're not like an anarchist necessarily, just mostly just aware of what's going on in the society.
Also, part of the characteristic is concern for the welfare of humanity. Now, WBAI, the positive mind... Gary Noe, a lot of people, Amy Goodman, a lot of the good folks out there, concerned for the welfare of humanity, something that you could really sense in a person. That money is not the whole issue. The dollar isn't. You know, sometimes you try to go to a place and you say, give me one of those, I don't want to pay for it because I have no money. And the guy says, no, I got to charge you for it. And even though you have no money, I have to charge for it because otherwise I wouldn't be able to keep the shop open and keep the other people happy. So you don't get angry at the guy who wants to charge you for your cupcakes. Capable of deep appreciation of basic life experience and establish a deep, satisfying interpersonal relationship with a few people. Well, that ends all of it. I mean,
I want to just go back to that second to last one that you said, Armand, capable of a deep appreciation for basic life experiences. I think that's really an interesting statement, and I've noticed in my personal experience that when I'm at my best on a personal level, I'm able to simply walk down the street and smile just to be alive. I mean, I can walk down the street. I know it maybe makes me seem like a crazy person, but I can walk down the street and just laugh because I feel good to be alive and walking down the street. And I think that's just a basic appreciation for a simple everyday experience. When I'm not in a good place mentally, I don't have those simple appreciative experiences.
So how will you walk down the street?
Well, this week I'm feeling great. So
let's say when you're not.
I won't notice the small things. I won't really appreciate things. I'll be preoccupied with the stresses and the difficulties that I'm currently facing. Whereas when I'm not in that mentality, I can walk down the street and smile just because I feel good. I know it's so simple, but it's actually...
What about if you feel really bad and you start kicking the dog?
Yeah, when I feel really bad, I walk through my life with blinders on.
Right. What's that like, Ben? You know, what's that like? Most of us know that experience. You get to a place where the mood is just junk and you want to hit anybody who loves you, right? That's your first target. Right, you love me, whack. You know, here it is.
Yeah.
You be mean, be mean to anybody.
Yeah, there's the difference, I think, between the two, the biggest difference is that one word, appreciation. So when you're in the negative headspace, the appreciation goes out the window. It's very difficult to look at anything in a positive light. And all the things that are positive in my life, when I'm in that sort of headspace, I take for granted. On the flip side, when I'm in that positive headspace, I feel immense gratitude and appreciation just to breathe in air and walk down the street.
What about you, Julian?
Well, yeah, it's interesting when you say on those great days you walk out and everything is kind of like these small things. And I live over on 9th Street and 2nd, and when I walk out of my house, I mean, 9 times out of 10, I'm looking around and I see the lights hanging across the street and the 4 coffee shops on my block and the 7 languages being spoken on my block. And it's like I can walk down my street, and if it's a good day, I'm noticing all of this. I'm seeing the people on the stoops, the people behind all of the coffee shop windows, and I really love to just breathe it in, as I walk down the street. And that same street, which becomes so beautiful during that time in my life when I'm feeling that way, can also just be such a dimly dark kind of place.
How would you perceive it as dark? What would you do? Look at it and find the smells disgusting? What would you do?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because there's so many people on my block always. There's always people walking back and forth. And when I'm feeling good, it's these people and life and energy and kind of bustling and excitement. And when it's dark for me, I look at them and I see these as people that don't see me at all. The sort of just walking past me, and I'll never know them, and I'll never understand, and I'm never there with them.
And they don't care anything
about
you.
And they don't care, and they'll never be
nothing about you.
Right.
So, by the way, just for you to know, our young man here used the expression "on my block." If you're listening to other than New York City, "on my block" has a meaning. Can we tell people what it means to say
"block"
on my block?
It's like a street. You walk down it. It's 1/20th of a mile.
It's a block.
And it's my block. There's a bunch of stoops on it.
And what's a stoop?
A stoop is a set of about 5 stairs going up to anywhere from 2 to 5 stairs.
And people sit on the stoops.
And people sit on the stoops drinking wine.
On the block.
Hanging out. Yeah. And there's some people that sit on the stoops that you think may have been there for about 60 years.
And there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people who are listening right now who have hung out on some of those stoops, on those blocks in Manhattan. And then there are people listening to us in Dublin right now, who probably have their own version of that.
Some kind of block.
Some kind of block, some
and
kind
some
of
kind
thing.
Of stoop. Yeah.
So one of the things that you look for in the self-actualization life is a peak experience. Now, what could a peak experience? Is a peak experience always love? Is that what it always is? You fall in love, that's my peak experience?
I think awareness. I think awareness is more of an apt term, because love is great, but it's not possible, I think, to always feel love, because we're walking through a complex world. We move through a complex world and a complex society, and not everything we deal with is going to be loving.
So when you say peak experiences, do you mean these self-actualized people, in fact, go into this situation and have the peak experience of that situation, the highest sensation?
It's a feeling. Sensation? It's a feeling of aha. It's a feeling of aha, aha. You know, it's kind of a recognition. Kind of takes you up a step.
Sure.
Up in the universe, just one step to a little point of clarity. And we all have that every now and then. It's like, aha, there is no Santa Claus. You know, aha.
What?
I'm sorry, I was just kidding.
No Santa Claus?
Then there's the need for privacy. Now, a lot of people can't be afraid, can't be alone, and a lot of people have to be alone. Where does privacy come in the middle of that? And let me see your cell phone. What do you mean I can't know the code to your cell phone? Let me see your voicemail.
Yeah,
let
I
me
mean,
see your
privacy
emails.
Becomes...
Let me see your texts. Let me see your...
Privacy becomes even more prevalent now, just when you have all of this information that sort of exists on something. You know, you have it on your phone, on your computers, on the internet. You know, they exist in that way. And privacy is, in fact, one of the characteristics of self-actualizers. Somebody who wants privacy, you're saying?
Well, I'm not sure, because, you know, I don't... I think at the highest level, I don't care about privacy.
I think
at my best self, I don't care. I don't care.
There's a time and a place, I think, where it's appropriate and where...
Is it less about the actual need for people not to know, and more just about respect for your own space and
respect
having time
for my boundaries and right. my space? Yes,
I think it's more about that rather than the actual fear of having somebody know something about you that you don't
right
want
hiding
to know.
Stuff right. right. Hiding. I don't want is it hiding stuff about right. me that I don't want people to know? That's called privacy, but it's not really privacy.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's
secrecy.
Yeah, secrecy. Exactly.
Yeah, that's the difference.
So you go to maybe a need for privacy from the need for secrecy,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, what about democratic attitudes?
I think the need for consensus in a group, whatever that group may be, that's a respectful sort of high-minded
yeah,
approach.
Yeah, the ability to look at both sides of whatever comes to being. I mean, around us, somebody who's self-actualized would say, okay, I see both sides of this. I agree with this one more, but I can definitely hear what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And finally, strong moral ethical standards.
Well, I believe in ethics, Armand, but I don't know about morals. I think the word moral has a lot more connotations than ethics, but I do believe mm-hmm. in being, you know, an ethical person, doing the right thing.
Well,
so to
what
speak.
Would be a morality, Ben? What would be a morality that you agree with? Don't abuse people who are powerless.
Well, I think, Armand, I think morality stems from a dogmatic, often religious concepts.
Yeah, that's the way we've known it in the past.
Yeah, and I think ethics are simply just about doing the right thing. And without any...
Oh, like priests do.
No.
No, I'm sorry. I thought they're very ethical.
But I strive to be ethical. And yet I think that one can be ethical. And I'm not against morals, but I think that morals lead to moralizing, which I'm not in favor of telling others how to live their lives. I just try to strive to do the right thing for myself in my life and
well,
for others
minute,
around
ben,
me.
Don't you have a tendency to want to tell people how to live their lives?
I don't think so.
You don't think you want to tell people that they should do this or do that?
No.
You really like people to just do their own thing.
I think people should do whatever they need to do to achieve their own happiness, as long as it doesn't infringe in others' happiness.
What infringes on your happiness when somebody looks at your morality? They say to you, hey, Ben, how could you, you know?
I wouldn't say that that infringes on my happiness, but I don't feel like I have to defend my actions, because I don't think that there's anything immoral about the way I live my life. I strive to be ethical, so I think honesty is a big component of that.
Oh, very big component.
You know, being honest with the people around me, that's important, and treating others fairly and with respect. That doesn't mean that I subscribe to like a dogmatic, you know, set of moral codes.
This is Armand DeMille with Ben Starr and Julian Joyella. We're talking about the needs, the basic needs, according to Maslow. Now, he talks about behaviors leading to it, to self-actualization. He said, experiencing life like a child with full absorption and concentration. This is a wonderful experience. If you could get that feeling of feeling childlike and being free in the world, and that, even Charlie, as a drummer, to be childlike is wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, it's a lot like what we were talking about, walking down the street and being curious about what's around every corner and looking at every piece of my block, or even if it's the same block, seeing what's new and wanting to understand everything around us, which is... I feel like I get there when I'm in that good place.
And trying new things instead of sticking to safe paths. I had a friend who was a therapist. He used to have people walk out of their room backwards. He said, when you leave your apartment, always leave backwards. He said, instead of leaving with your front going out the door, leave with your back going out the door. He just did that. And for some strange reason, that made everything a little different for people when they left home. Listening to your own feelings in evaluating experiences instead of the voices of tradition, authority, or the majority, avoiding pretense and being honest, being prepared to be unpopular in your view, taking responsibility and working hard.
And trying to identify your defenses and having the courage to give them up or surrender them. I think all of those that you just mentioned, Armand, tie into being an ethical person.
So we're going to be taking a short break. When we come back from our break, we're going to be going over some of the ways that you get to see yourself. We don't have our phones coming in today because Verizon's having some trouble with the lines. So we have no calls coming in, but you do have email. Armand@thepositivemind.com. And if you send us an email, we may read it on the air and then give you some feedback right on air. But when we come back, we're going to be talking about some of the ways that you can become more self-aware. Okay? And we will also, as I said, we'll be back here tomorrow with this new group trying to take over while I fly up to the West Coast. And
don't forget, people, you can always reach out to us on Twitter as well, at Armand DeMille, ArmandDimele.
We'll be right back.
I'm not the kind of man who tends to socialize. I seem to lean on old familiar ways. And I ain't no fool for love songs that whisper in my ears. Still crazy. Morning. course. I fear I'll do some damage one fine day. But I would not be convicted by a jury of my peers. Still crazy.
Still crazy after all these years. That was Paul Simon here on The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. You know, Armand, Paul Simon went to the same school as me.
He did?
Yeah, Queens College.
Good place. Good place. I know a lot of people who graduated from there. Seemed to have been a decent place. But, you know, as you get through life, following on what we were saying, any emails, by the way?
Yeah, I was just checking.
As you get through life, you find... Oh, here's one. Let me look at this one. Hi, Armand. How do you know when you're just being your old natural self or if you're trying on something new out of fear? That's a very interesting question. How do you know if you're being your old natural self or your more natural self or you're just functioning out of fear? Mostly, I guess you could tell from the tension inside your body. You know, mostly it's the tension that you feel. If there's a certain amount of tension that goes along with it, that's usually a good giveaway. Let's talk about the process of emotional evolution. Emotional evolution is a process of learning. In this case, you're looking to learn about your mind. See, now people like me, they call us therapists. We're supposed to be tutors of the mind. Ideally, we teach you how to sort out your thoughts and feelings so that you could successfully pursue your goals, but you could do that yourself. But you want to sort out your thoughts and feelings, and the difference between thoughts and feelings is enormous. A lot of people say, try to say what they feel, but they can't identify what they feel. All they know is what they think. So if you ask somebody, what do you feel? And they say, well, I feel like going home. They're really telling you what they're thinking. They're telling you a thought process. Feelings have certain sensations to it, and it gets very hard to interpret feelings. It seems that somewhere a long time ago, you were told not to allow your feelings to happen. So learning the skills of introspection, learning how to learn the difference between thinking and feeling, that's quite a remarkable thing to do. There's a lot of good tools in Gestalt therapy, G-E-S-T-A-L-T, therapy. They have a few books on that that really help you. But there are three stages of emotional evolution. One is awareness. At the beginning of your trip, you and your friend or you and your partner or you alone, you examine what contributes to your current dissatisfaction. You begin to explore the thoughts, situations, and behaviors that cause you pain. What hurts you? What is the situation that causes you pain? You look at the situations and you try to see them and just see them. Once you've learned how to identify them, you learn that you can't blame anybody else for them. There's nobody else causing these feelings. This is really something that you have created and perpetuated, and it's very hard to believe that. It's very hard to believe, well, you know, I'm just an innocent, and my partner there, he abused me, and therefore I'm an abused innocent for the fifth time. Well, at some point you turn around and say, wait a minute, there must have been some part of me that was inviting this. Ask me questions, by the way, if it doesn't make sense. So getting to know your situation means giving up the blame factor.
And are you saying the blame factor of for yourself?
Yeah, nobody made me feel this way. Nobody put me in this situation. I put myself in this situation. Yes, I may have had abusive parents. Sure, sure. But if I continue that abusiveness, if I continue going with people who are abusive to me, I can't blame my parents anymore, but I'd like to identify it. This is who I am.
Where's the impulse coming from?
Yeah, I only know love through abuse. So you learn about it and you try to spot it without blaming anybody else. Now, the big trick here is you don't blame yourself either. Because what people tend to do is they go from blaming others to blaming themselves. And blaming yourself doesn't do any good either. Because putting yourself down does just that. It puts you down. Well, we don't want you down. We want you up. We want you level. We want you able to communicate, to talk. So having you on your feet, ready to face yourself, means standing up in front of a mirror, but not criticizing yourself and not blaming anyone else. Once you've learned the techniques for identifying yourself and what you feel, then comes the thing about taking off your blinders and taking a better look at the world. In this case, what happens is you do not change your behaviors. It is most people see what they're doing and then immediately say, now I've got to change. I see that I'm going out with the wrong kind of guy. I'm going to go out with the other kind of guy. Big mistake.
So would you say that's the difference between awareness and knowledge? Because you mentioned that awareness was at step one of any kind of process of emotional evolution.
Yes, and knowledge is being at the step and not changing it. You see, they're all ghosts. We have inside of us invisible forces that don't want us to see them. These invisible forces want us to stay the same. And they want us to just stay the same. We want them to manifest. We want to hear the voices. We want to see who we really are. You know, are you a person who wants to be alone? Well, I'm complaining I really don't want to be alone because I'm lonely, because I keep looking for somebody and I sign up for all the matching sites and I do all this stuff. Look, I'm trying so hard. Well, maybe you're somebody who wants to be alone. Identify this. Just see where you are, where your spot is. The difficulty we have is that if you identify it and try to change it, you generally will lose the ability to see it. So make no changes. Freud, who was a very young amateurish therapist, had as a rule, if anybody went into therapy with him, he would make them promise no changes in their lives for 2 years. Don't change your marriage. Don't get a divorce. Don't change your job. Because the job was to get to know yourself. If you change the situation, you lose track of yourself. Very often a person will come into therapy and they'll start to learn about themselves. And what do? They fall in love with somebody. And now all they want to talk about is their love relationship. And the therapist will try to help them talk about their love relationship by getting them closer to each other and talking about the relationship. But the therapist shouldn't even be involved in this. The person is really a person learning about themselves.
I just wanted to say we got an email asking, hi, Armand, can you obtain freedom from fear without taking medication?
Sure. Okay. Give me just a minute, and I'll give you the answer. I have it right. I'm going through a book. So, fear. Fear. Remember, fear is a reaction to a perceived threat. Fear is a reaction to a perceived threat. We have this mechanism as a mechanism of survival. Fear is our friend. It is not our enemy. Right? So once fear is seen, when it's not acceptable, we push it from the conscious to the unconscious. And when we push it into the unconscious, it has all kinds of power over us, which we don't want. So first of all, we have this fear being felt. Now, all of God's creatures are born with a mechanism that has but one purpose, which is to keep us alive. This survival mechanism is a spirit. It's a thing in us that is unconscious. It controls our conscious and unconscious. I call this part of us the engineer. It's our best friend. It keeps our interest in mind. When it perceives a threat, it responds by going to protect you. Now, there are certain people in the Enneagram, the sixes especially, they have more fear than do the other folk. They feel more of it. It's almost like that was their job. They were supposed to be on the borders, letting everybody know when there's a threat. Fear is a natural survival mechanism. In order to get past it, well, it's hard work. It's hard work. But to get past it, you got to let yourself feel it all the way. Now, I've had the experience of having people come in to my offices and the offices of other people I know. Instead of fear, I want them to feel terror. And there is a way of moving from fear to terror just by doing certain therapeutic interventions. When a person can feel terror, just figure what this is like. You come in, you're a little frightened. You know, I'm afraid of the guy in the window. I'm afraid of mice. Really popular one. Imagine, I would say to the person, imagine the mice crawling all over you and let yourself have your reaction. We're going to lose some listeners right this minute. Now imagine yourself feeling this horrible reaction. It's horrible. You can't stand it. You feel like screaming. But you're really in my chair with me, and there are no mice. And you're going through it, and you're going through it, and you're going through it. And then I have them give the mice a voice. And the mice say, I'm going to destroy you, I'm going to eat you, I'm going to hurt you. And then I have them discover or uncover why the mice want to punish you. And through this uncovery, through the intensity of it, the person says, I'm going to kill you because you're bad. I'm going to kill you because you talked back to your mother. I'm going to kill you because... And then it starts to uncover. The very reason that the fear was created starts to uncover. Once that is felt, once you get to the basis of that, once you get to the terror, which is beyond the fear dissipates. It goes away. I've seen it hundreds of times with people. It's very serious business. That's one way. Another way, take a medication. A third way is try to become rational, and you push it out of your mind. The trouble with pushing it out of your mind is that just by pushing it out of your mind, you push other things out with it. And sometimes you lose something like other feelings, which is what we don't want.
When you say become rational, do you mean give the facts more weight
right,
than the feelings?
Right, give the facts more weight than the feelings. Fear is not the enemy. It's the unacceptability of fear. You know, it's when a person's afraid of taking risks, it's because they haven't allowed their normal fears to exist consciously. You know, children, when they're afraid, are terrified. You know, when they're terrified, somehow they've got to be loved in there. When they're not loved, that terror just exists. What is fear all about? Fear is just simply, I'm not safe. And learning to feel safe is a very difficult thing.
So thanks, Patty Ann, for that email. It really brought some interesting stuff here. We have another email from Cricket.
Hey, Cricket, talk about musicians. Great bass player, Charlie.
He says, I'm a long-time listener. I'll be 67 on April 13th. My life has had good and bad times and all in between, yet now, quote-unquote, after all these years, I am at the most difficult time of my life. It is very hard to cope.